Hello and welcome to the Institute of Nutritional Endocrinology presentation on macronutrients, carbohydrates, and their clinical applications. Up to this point, we've looked at carbohydrates, their structure, their function, the biochemistry, and now we're going to take a look at what happens when you cook them. How do the carbohydrates become more or less bioavailable in terms of the way that they're prepared? How do you determine whether the person you're working with needs a higher carbohydrate diet, a lower carbohydrate diet, a medium carbohydrate diet? And we'll take a look at all of these factors. Before we begin, I do want to remind you that this presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one consultation with a qualified healthcare professional. It's certainly not medical advice. And when you're working with your own clients, be sure to let them know that what you're offering them is an overall evaluation of where they're at nutritionally, along with education about how they can improve their overall health and their diet. But by no means is it medical advice. And if they're under the care of a doctor for being on medication or other diagnosed health condition, make sure that they know to consult with their doctor and make sure whatever educational resources you're making available are okay in light of the current treatment protocol they have with their doctor. So let's take a look at how various cooking methodologies will affect the availability of carbohydrates. A cooked carbohydrate is not necessarily the same as the same food raw because of the way that it's handled in the body. So what does cooking do to carbohydrates? Well, there's some evidence that it facilitates the conversion of the starch molecules into sugar. It makes the sugar more bioavailable by breaking down the cellulose and the other fiber in the food. It also increases the glycemic index of the food. And the glycemic index is the rating of how much that food is purported to raise blood sugar. It's not an exact science. It's not an index that I really pay a lot of mind to. And we'll go into way more detail about the glycemic index in our blood sugar balancing module. It actually increases the available calories because when you heat the starch and it breaks down the fiber, it releases a lot of the calories from the food that were trapped and bound with the fiber out to be available to you to be absorbed. And this might be good in terms of someone who is thin and needs to facilitate all the calories they can from a food without so much extra bulk. But for people who are attempting to let go of some weight, which quite frankly is the majority of people you're going to see, that's not such a good deal. It decreases what's called the resistant starch content. And resistant starch content is starch that actually, I guess you could say it more acts like fiber than it does starch, because it resists breakdown from digestive enzymes and fuels its way through the intestinal tract. It also creates, when you heat things at high heat, and especially dry high heat, for example, baking in the oven, it produces a chemical called acrylamide. And acrylamide is a known carcinogen. And this is pretty important because most people aren't aware of it. They're not aware that their baked corn chips or baked potato chips, while not having high contents of oxidized fats, are actually not good for them either because of the existence of acrylamide. Same thing happens with baked potatoes, fried potatoes, etc. And we have a chart that's going to show you where the top 20 foods by average acrylamide content exist. So French fries made in restaurants, because they're very hot and very, you know, the ovens tend to be hotter and drier, and French fries that are oven baked. Potato chips, you know, very crispy, heated at very high temperatures. Breakfast cereals, cookies, even coffee, brewed coffee, toast, pies and cakes, chili con carne, corn snacks, popcorn, pretzels, pizzas, crackers, soft bread, coffee, which is very interesting that coffee would be a problem, but it's definitely in the articles that I found. Burritos and tostadas, peanut butter, breaded chicken because of the breading, bagels, and soup mix. So these are the things that have been measured to have the highest acrylamide. In general, think about it as a starch. If you're going to heat a starch, you want it to be at a moist, low temperature. So for example, steaming. Steamed potatoes are much different in their acrylamide content than are French fries or baked potatoes. So given that carbs are one of the major food groups and there's a need for carbs, it's not that they're the bad guys really, it's just that they get to be excessive and we get to take in the wrong kinds of carbs, which we looked at before. We looked at the complex versus the simple carbs. And in our society, in the general diet, especially the standard American diet, we have a preponderance of calories from carbs in the simple form, from sugars, the baked goods, the chips, the cookies, the candies, etc. So then there's a shift here to go towards a much lower carb diet. Like the paleo movement is big, and paleo is pushing very low carbs, as is a ketogenic diet, which is extreme low carbs. Ketogenic diet is an extreme low carb, higher fat diet that's been shown to be effective in things like multiple sclerosis and epileptic seizures. It's also been shown to be helpful in some cases of cancer. Is it a good maintenance diet? Probably not, except for someone who's become very ill and needs it to maintain a seizure-free environment or to reverse their multiple sclerosis. Generally, these extreme diets are used therapeutically for short periods of time. The thing about the paleo diet is that if you look at it from the way that it's actually done versus the way that it ought to be done, it's a very different monster. So people who are like, yeah, paleo, are eating, you know, big slabs of bacon and lots of meat and butter and very little in the way of vegetables. And remember, on the complex carbohydrate side, one of the biggies was vegetables. And I'm going to show you in a little bit how you can actually get plenty of carbs but have them be the low, slow carbs, and that would be mainly from your non-starchy vegetables. So sometimes people do need higher carb intake, and this is for people especially who are very thin and need to gain weight. It's hard to gain a lot of extra weight on fat and protein calories. It just really is. People who need to gain weight tend to need to have extra carbs. Now, I'm not saying they need extra carbs in the form of sugar or breads or things like that, but extra carbs in the form of starchy vegetables and some of the gluten-free grains. People who are competitive athletes, they're burning up like crazy, and they need to have the carbs to fuel that exercise, to have available glucose in their bloodstream to fuel their exercise so they don't break down their protein. People who generally have a higher caloric need might need to have extra carbs, higher carbs. Growing children tend to do better with higher carbs. And again, I'm talking good carbs, carbs from starchy vegetables, from things like fruits, and from non-gluten grains, and legumes to an extent as well. And then pregnancy is another time when higher carb may be needed, but diabetes in pregnancy is very common. It's called gestational diabetes. So you really have to be watching somebody who's pregnant and discover what the best level of carbs would be for them to keep their blood sugar nice and steady. In general, that's the way you're going to work with people, is to really evaluate each person as an individual and not just have the, well, I put people on low-fat diets or I put people on low carbohydrate diets. No, it's really very individual, and you need to be looking at each and every person as a unique person with unique needs. So what are the potential dangers of having too low a carbohydrate intake? Well, studies have shown that when the carbohydrates get too low, it increases the level of cortisol. When there aren't enough carbohydrates in the diet to supply the fuel that you need for your activity, naturally the body's going to try to raise that level of glucose. The first way to do that, the preferred way, is to use the hormone glucagon to go break down storage form of starch, which, remember what that is? That's glycogen, usually stored in the muscles and the liver. However, if a person's been following a low carbohydrate diet for a while, they are not going to have very much glycogen in their muscles. So that's quickly going to run out. And then it becomes, quote unquote, an emergency. And the adrenals get into play and start secreting adrenaline and cortisol. Cortisol goes out to muscle and breaks it down to create new sugar, new glucose in the blood. It basically breaks down branched chain amino acids. So I always tell people, don't get stressed out, because when you do, you turn your thigh muscles into belly fat. But in the case of too low a carbohydrate intake, you have similar response. That's actually a stress on the body because the adrenals are coming in to try to balance it. The numbers, what are the numbers? The numbers I've seen mostly are when you go below 100 grams of carbohydrate a day. And I'll show you in a little bit that it's not really hard to stay above 100 when you include lots of non-starchy vegetables in your diet and nuts and seeds. So there are some studies that show that this, in concert with that increase in cortisol, we also get a decrease in testosterone. Mainly, I think that has to do with the cortisol steal effect. We've seen that before, where testosterone and cortisol use the same precursor. So if we're increasing our cortisol, it's going to naturally decrease testosterone, as well as some of the other steroid hormones. As a result of the increased cortisol, it disrupts the conversion of T4 to T3. So you get less T3, which means the metabolic rate goes down, which means that fat burning slows down, and which means that you can come up with a whole host of symptoms related to low thyroid function. Of course, you know, it can result in low energy because the body doesn't have readily available glucose to use. And then muscle wasting as a result of the increased cortisol. So you see, you know, it's not really about high carbohydrate diet, a low carbohydrate diet. It's really about figuring out what the best level of carbohydrate is for each individual person. And it takes some experimentation sometimes. You know, sometimes you just try to find a spot and you move in either direction. Meanwhile, you can assess how well it's working for someone based on their symptoms, their energy level, their muscle tone. You can also use a glucose meter. We go way more into detail on using the glucose meter. We'll touch on it now in this presentation and go way more into detail when we do blood sugar balancing. What types of carbs should you be offering to people? You know, I certainly think there's never a case for giving somebody pure sugar, simple carbs, you know, refined flour products. Never. You can get plenty of carbohydrates in a healthy form that come in a healthy package with other nutrients, with fiber, with vitamins, and with minerals. So the grains, as we've talked about, whole versus processed. Processed grains are devoid of fiber, they're devoid of the B vitamins, they're devoid of the germ, they're devoid of a lot. So whole grains, preferably non-gluten grains, and the things that I feel are really good, healthy carbs are actually the grains that are more considered seeds, like buckwheat, quinoa, teff, millet, sometimes amaranth too. Legumes. Some people handle legumes really well. Some people don't. Some people get gas from the fermentable sugars in legumes. Some people handle them well. Some people handle different legumes differently. I had a client who could eat, black beans, but she couldn't eat garbanzo beans because the garbanzo beans shot her blood sugar up. It's going to be different from person to person. That's why you kind of do your best in assessing where the person's at, assessing their needs, and of course you got to look at their taste buds and their habits too, because you got to get compliance, right? So you look at that and then you determine what should you have this person try. Fruits. You know, some people do phenomenally with fruits and some people don't. There's a tendency to use fruits in ways that are not healthy, which is fruit juices, which is pure sugar water, or fruit purees, like smoothies, but not smoothies without greens in them. So it's really a matter of finding what their tolerance is. Low glycemic fruits like berries tend to work better than higher glycemic fruits like mangoes. But there are ways that you can figure out how to balance it by including like the low glycemic, high nutrient dense, chlorophyll rich greens. And we go way more into that in our blood sugar balancing module. Vegetables, personally, I'm going to show my bias here. I think that non-starchy vegetables are your best form of carbs, because in the quantities that most people eat them, i.e. a little tiny bit on a plate with the whole rest of the plate being other stuff like carbs and starchy vegetables and grains and pasta and meat and all that, I think that we need to be eating a large percentage of the meals as vegetables. And when you do, you can get a significant amount of carbs that are slow release carbs, as well as tons of minerals and vitamins and chlorophyll. So my bias is a lot of vegetables for the carbs. And I'm going to show you in a little bit a day in the life of, it was just a general estimation, but to show you that without any concentrated quote unquote protein sources or carb sources, we had quite a substantial amount of both in the diet. So vegetables are key. They're the best source of, and I mean the non-starchy vegetables. So some of these foods contain soluble versus insoluble fiber. So soluble fiber, like I said earlier, is the fiber that will dissolve in water. And soluble fiber is found in certain fruits. It's fruits that contain pectin. It's also found in legumes. And it's found in, to an extent, in vegetables. Vegetables also contain insoluble fiber, i.e. cellulose, which as we've seen is a very long chain of glucose molecules strung together, but we don't have the enzyme machinery to efficiently break down that down, so it basically goes through. Grains are typically very high in insoluble fiber, although some of them have a little bit more of the soluble. Things like chia seeds and flax seeds and those mucilaginous type foods tend to have more of the soluble fibers in them. Of course, sugar, bah! We don't want to ever have people take sugar unless they're about to go into a diabetic coma and you need to stick sugar under their tongue to bring them out of it. Really no need for sugar. And sugar alcohols. So we'll go through the sugar and the sugar alcohols in a lot more detail in the sugar presentation video. So how do you know if people are tolerating the carbs and what the deal is with them? Well, there's a number of ways to test the blood sugar and how the blood sugar is reacting, both on a short-term basis and on a long-term basis, how it's reacting to the diet. So fasting blood glucose, not the best. It's first thing in the morning before you get up, before anybody eats anything, you take their blood sugar. That's typically what the traditional medicine will look at, but way more so than they will look at some of these others. And it just is a shot in time, one point in time. And actually, when we're assessing for things like diabetes, it's the last thing to change. So somebody could be having raging blood sugar imbalances for many years before the fasting blood glucose goes awry. We've got home testing. We can have buy one of these little units. They can run anywhere from, you know, $10 to $40, depending on which one you get. The one I usually recommend is a very inexpensive one, between $10 and $15. It's called the True to Go meter and the True Results test strips. And you can test before a meal and before exercise and see what the glucose is. And then you can test it after the meal and after the exercise. And there's a very specific regime that I have to offer you in terms of that. And we'll include the glucose testing page, the tracking sheet on this page, so that you can have access to it. And then we'll go into way more detail about it when we do our blood sugar balancing module. And then there's hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is the measure of the average glucose in the blood over a period of time. Usually it's measure of how it's been over the last 3 months. So it's an accurate assessment of how well the person's been maintaining, but it doesn't change very rapidly when you're making changes to someone's diet. You kind of have to wait a whole 3 months. And what hemoglobin A1C is, how glycosylated or sugar-coated the hemoglobin is. And hemoglobin is a carrier protein that takes iron around the blood. It's basically how you measure if a person's anemic, iron deficient anemic or not. among other things. So hemoglobin A1C is how glycosylated, how much sugar coating does that hemoglobin have in the system? And it should be below 5%. If it gets too low, it means that you're probably maintaining too low of blood glucose, but below 5 is really good. Fructosamine is actually measuring the amount of sugar coating on particular amino acid, and it forms a thing called fructosamine, which is more of a short-term measure. It can measure over the course of a month. I'll often do a combination of all of these, including insulin, which is the last thing listed, because it's important to get the big picture. You know, how much insulin are they producing? Are they insulin resistant? Are they having hyper, meaning high insulin surges? How well are they maintaining their blood glucose? Do they have higher than usual amounts of fructosamine or hemoglobin A1C? How are they doing after meals? And then, of course, the fasting, which is usually the last to go. Let's take a quick look at a label. And I know you know how to read labels. You've read them before. But just to reiterate, when you're teaching somebody how to read labels, you are looking for carbohydrates. You're looking for total carbohydrates. So in this particular case, total carbohydrate is 15. But we don't know, is that good carbohydrate or is that mostly sugar carbohydrate? Well, the next thing I skipped down to is looking at sugars. It's 4 grams of sugar. Okay, so what else is making up that total carbohydrate? Well, 4 grams of sugar I don't think is very good for a food. I think it's a little bit too much, but 4 grams of sugar it is. So we have 4 grams of sugar and we have 4 grams of dietary fiber. So what that means, and then we have 3 grams of sugar alcohol. So if you had 4 plus 4 is 8, 8 plus 3 is 11. That's 11. What happened to the other 4 grams of carbohydrate? And that would be in the form of starch, longer chain polysaccharides. Okay, this particular food has 2 grams of protein. So when we look down, the other thing you want to teach your people when they're eating, first ingredient in this is wheat flour. Obviously, that's not a good thing. First of all, it's not whole wheat, but wheat is, you know, gluten. We'll have a whole thing on gluten and how that can affect people's energy and their hormones. So wheat flour, unsweetened chocolate, erythritol, inulin. Erythritol is one of the sugar alcohols. Inulin is that longer chain of fructooligosaccharides. It's kind of a starch, an insoluble starch, an insoluble fiber. Oat flour, cocoa powder, evaporated cane juice. That's going to drive the sugar up. Whey protein, and whey protein is actually a mixed bag because as we'll learn in the blood sugar balancing program, you know, people like are really pushing whey is great, but whey actually drives up insulin levels, and that might be good in somebody who has low insulin levels, like a type 1 diabetic. But in general, high insulin levels leads to increased fat storage and all the damage that it does to blood vessels and blood pressure, etc. Cornstarch, and it says low glycemic. I don't understand how that could be low glycemic. Natural flavor salts, wheat gluten, they've added extra gluten. So this is not a good food, as you probably know by reading it. But you look at this, the label, and that's how you tell if a food is high in starches or not. You subtract the dietary fiber and the sugar and the sugar alcohols from the total carbohydrate, and that will give you the amount of starch in there. That's just another example of a nutrition label. And you know, the thing is, there's a variety of different fruits that can be good for people. And what's good for one person might be bad for another. Red apples tend to be higher in sugar than are the green apples. So go for the green apples when people are doing the apples. And apples contain pectin, which is a soluble fiber, which will slow down the absorption of that food. Here's a list of carbohydrate content in food, and on the website we'll have 3 PDF documents that will share with you more detail on this. But these are just the starchy stuff, and you can see that, you know, most of these foods have anywhere from 30 up to 60 some grams of protein, of a carbohydrate. And if you look at it, a low carbohydrate diet is considered under 100. A very low carbohydrate diet is considered under 50. A moderate carbohydrate diet is anywhere from 100 to 250. So you could see that just the one serving of baked potato is going to give you 64 grams. So if you're going for a lower carbohydrate diet, you need to be aware of where the carbohydrate is coming from. This is a log I did on fitday.com. I used to use it, I used to play with it before, and it was much easier to use, but now it's just crammed with advertisements. But it took me a while to get this in. I was trying to put in, what if I had a chia porridge in a smoothie for breakfast, a salad with some dip or dressing for lunch, and then some steamed vegetables with maybe flax oil on it for dinner. I mean, I gave up after a while, so this isn't complete. Actually, the hemp seeds are missing because they didn't have it in the database. But hemp seeds would add about 5 grams of protein and another 5 grams of carbohydrate to this, plus some really good omega-3 fats. So as you can see, given this, It's really not bad. It's not a very low carbohydrate diet, but it's more of a moderate carbohydrate diet. But all the carbohydrates, look, are from your veggies and your nuts and seeds. So what I'm saying is we don't have to get people into eating a lot of starches and legumes if we don't want to, if they don't tolerate them, if there are reasons for them not to do it. But you can still keep the carbohydrate in a level, at a level that's not going to cause an excess of cortisol. I have seen, though, people go, like on my Before Be Gone program, and they go real extreme the first couple of days, and they end up with palpitations and other signs of high cortisol and adrenaline. So it's really a matter of really working with people and figuring out what the best is for them. So let's lastly look at carbohydrate intolerance and the special diets. Okay, there's a lot of different carbohydrate-related special diets. Of course, first of all is lactose intolerance. People who don't digest milk sugar need to be on a dairy-free diet. Personally, I think everybody should be on a dairy-free diet because dairy is generally the milk of another species, which is intended for the young of that species. Yes, there are therapeutic cases where some fermented goat's kefir might be helpful, where colostrum or even sometimes whey protein, as long as it's clean and cold processed, might be useful. That's more of a medicine, a food as medicine. But we're looking at food as food. I think most people should be off of dairy. I've seen it cause way too many problems. So lactose intolerance is the inability to break down the bond between glucose and galactose in the lactose sugar. And that enzyme that's missing is lactase. Now, some people will cheat and just drink their milk and take the lactase enzyme. That's okay, but they're really not addressing the problems with casein, which we talked about in protein. I think that another diet that's common is low glycemic. Well, what does that mean, a low glycemic diet? Well, it depends on whether you're looking at the glycemic index or the glycemic load, but that would be to eat foods that are under a certain level of rating. Now, I don't know, you know, I consider what I do low glycemic eating because there's completely devoid of any kinds of heavy duty processed starches and sugars. So again, it's a matter of finding for that person, does that low sugar, low glycemic diet, is it below 100 grams? Do they need a ketogenic diet for a while to get in balance because of a neurologic issue? You have to figure that out and play with it. Gluten-free and grain-free. Well, gluten has been shown to be detrimental in all sorts of problems, contributes to depression, contributes to thyroid conditions, problematic with autoimmune. A lot of people don't tolerate grains very well because it causes spikes in their blood sugars. And again, you'll have to see how it works. Some people might do really well with quinoa and not with rice. The thing you have to keep in mind, and we'll talk more when we do immune system, is that there are certain cross-reactivities that happen when someone is gluten intolerant and they don't tolerate some of the other grains like corn and rice and quinoa. Another diet which you may hear about and probably have some familiarity with is the specific carbohydrate diet. And another word for it is the GAPS diet. They're actually very similar. There's very little difference between them. One is based on the other. And it eliminates all sugars except for monosaccharides, all starches as well. So monosaccharides are the only ones allowed in. So glucose or fructose or galactose would be allowed, but none of the others. I think that there's merit to some of this because people may not have the ability to break down the disaccharides, and it causes a lot of bloating and gas. And there have been some good studies that show that the specific carbohydrate diet can work well with people with Crohn's and other inflammatory bowel diseases. In our digestion module, you'll see a modified specific carbohydrate diet that I put together, and also a modified diet that takes out all the FODMAP and the specific carbohydrate things that they tell you to avoid and leaves you with a fairly good and wide range of veggies that you can eat. It's just a matter of seeing. I generally don't go to these types of diets unless the typical stuff doesn't work. You know, the obvious is you get people off of the refined carbs. You get them off of the gluten, off of the dairy, off of any other food intolerances that they have, and then address the specific needs as you see fit if those first line of defense things are not working well. And then FODMAPs, what is that? That's one of the latest in these carbohydrate-specific special diets. The FODMAP stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. So if you look back at the GAPS diet, which only allows monosaccharides, this further takes the monosaccharides out as well. So anything, oligosaccharides, which are the medium chains, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. And it allows for the polysaccharides. Polyols are the sugar alcohols. So again, some people do really well with this. A lot of it, I think, has to do with the gut flora. And so oftentimes you can restrict the foods on the FODMAP list, and then you can address the gut, address the bacteria in the gut by adding some good probiotic foods, get things cleaned up, and then you can broaden the spectrum. I believe that a lot of these intolerances come from poor digestion, not having the right bacteria, and just years and years, basically, of abuse. So these are these in a nutshell, and we will go through more details about some of these and give you the specifics of what's included and what's not in our food religions module. So let's do a review. Good carbs, bad carbs. A good carb to one person might be a bad carb to the other. So it's very important that you take a good history, get a good diet diary, a good symptom diary, and personalize your recommendation to the individual. In general, processed carbs are bad for everyone. It's just the way it is. Gut health may temporarily restrict some intake of carbohydrate. So for example, if you're working with somebody who has an inflamed gut, they have either a diagnosed or kind of generic inflamed gut. So maybe they have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or just an inflammatory gut disease. They are not going to feel comfortable if you feed them a lot of cellulose-containing foods. So for example, raw green leafy vegetables, very high in cellulose, that can be very aggravating because it acts like a broom. And think about running a broom over an inflamed raw surface. So that might be it. Now, other gut health, you have bad bacteria, dysbiosis in the gut, you may not be able to take some of those carbohydrates, and you may have to follow a FODMAP or an SCD diet for a while. Glucose tolerance does play a major role, and I think a lot of this is overlooked by most folks who recommend these special diets, is that you really need to look at how is the person responding on a glucose level. What happens to their glucose after they eat a specific meal? And learning to play around and alter the composition of those meals so that you could help them to achieve balance, glucose balance. Again, way more detail in our blood sugar balancing module. Restriction of good carbs is generally temporary when healing. So for example, on the FODMAPs, you may be eliminating things like kale and broccoli, cauliflower, for a while. It's generally got to be temporary, because if you follow some of these diets long term, you're going to create nutrient imbalances. Same thing is true if you've got someone with an inflammatory bowel disease. Yeah, temporarily, take them off of the raw vegetables because they can be irritating. Put them on raw vegetable juices, which are non-irritating. All in all, what we need to do is really treat each person as an individual. Listen to what they have to say. They will be able to help pinpoint what's going on if you listen and ask the right questions. So enjoy working with your clients on these carbohydrate issues. Thanks.